A day full of looking at things that make us go, huh, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheath, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is my very good friend, your co-host, my Vice Chairman, Chuck Michaels.
And it's good to be here, Barry. It's good to have things, our schedule kind of back to normal. We kind of messed up earlier in the week and missed the show due to technical difficulties, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, and those technical difficulties were basically all on our end of it, so we want to apologize to our listeners who may have been confused, but just know that you can listen to the programs from the week archived in order on our website at principledpolicy.com. So if you want to go over there to listen to that series of programs that we were doing in relation to some of those issues, and you were listening to us live on the radio, well, I guess you were live, we weren't, we were pre-recorded. But if you were listening to that and kind of wondered why we got out of sync, well, that was a difficulty that's something we had overlooked because of the holiday on Monday. So anyhow, we got it straightened out. We want to thank Mike Lamnick at WLRY for helping us get that straightened out. And like I said, you can go and listen to that in its entirety in order on our website. So if you want to do that and follow up after this program today. But today, Chuck, you and I have been talking over the week, and whether it's through the mainstream media or whether it's through what would most people would consider the conservative media, there are still issues out there that people bring these things up, and you just have to sit there and go, oh, what are they thinking?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You and I found a couple of really, really choice pieces to talk about today in that vein. I guess we're going to call this our I Can't Believe They're Saying This department. But ladies and gentlemen, you know, on this program, we have tried to look at things from both a biblical and a constitutional perspective. And it's in that latter vein that we wanted to talk about this issue today, because as well know that many of you who do listen to the station are very conservative. And most conservative folks' tendencies are to, when they look at media, they look at certain media. It's just, you know, it's a standard thing. Instead of listening to CNN, you probably listen to Fox News. Instead of listening to the Rachel Maddow program, you might be listening to Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. And when you're reading online blogs, you're probably not going to Talking Points Memo. You probably are going to WorldNet Daily. And it was on WorldNet Daily this week, and Chuck and I, neither one of us had seen the article until we got multiple emails from people in our networks who know that we are concerned about the Constitution, that we teach classes on it, and that we are very outspoken on our position and view on the dangers of firing up what would be considered an Article 5 federal constitutional convention, that they sent this article to us, because this article was first posted on WorldNet Daily earlier this week on the 15th of January. So it was posted, I guess, over the weekend then, Chuck.
Yeah.
But it was posted by someone who most people consider fairly conservative, Larry Klayman, who's the founder of Judicial Watch and who's done quite a bit in trying to expose issues of ethics in government. But Charles, I think that Mr. Klayman, who I believe is an attorney, I think his training got ahead of his common sense in this particular article.
I honestly am wondering if there's some kind of a game being played here. And you and I have spoken about this game before. It's called constitutional brinksmanship.
Yes.
And what it is the idea that you play this game where everybody comes up to the edge of a precipice, and the precipice being a new constitutional convention. And as we all get to this precipice, we look over the edge, see that it is a bottomless pit, and everybody backs away and says, okay, it's time to make a different kind of deal so that we don't fall over this precipice. And that's what has gone on umpteen times in our country's history. There are radicals who are absolutely dead set on rewriting the Constitution of the United States of America because it's quote unquote outdated. Klayman sort of takes a swipe at that. He makes a statement that is frankly a little bit absurd in this article in WorldNet Daily. And we'll attach a link to the article, and then we'll also attach a link to our paper on why an Article 5 convention would be a very bad idea.
Absolutely. Now, he titles his article, Chuck, the headline, Why We Need a Constitutional Convention, with an exclamation point at the end of it. So right there is the first sign that something's not all right in the House of Klayman right now. So,
well, let's take a quote out of here. Over the course of the last 224 years since it was ratified by the states, serious structural flaws in it have emerged. such that additional amendments, 27 to be exact, have proven necessary. I'll be quite honest. There's a whole bunch of that 27 that shouldn't be in there. I will speak specifically to two, the 16th and the 17th. Yeah. Does Larry Klayman really think that dismantling the structure of the Constitution to the point where you destroy federalism was a great idea? Was something that would be absolutely necessary?
That would be the 17th Amendment, which is the direct election of United States senators, which the Constitution actually had it in its framework that the state legislatures appointed the two U.S. senators from each state, therefore giving the state governments a direct check upon the power of the federal government.
Exactly. Does Larry Klayman really think that that was a structural flaw that had to be fixed? Does Larry Klayman really think that allowing the federal government to directly tax the income without apportionment of the citizens directly was a structural flaw that needed to be fixed? Does Larry Klayman really think that the District of Columbia needed to be treated as a state as far as presidential electors go and given three electoral votes?
If you take him at his word and what he wrote in this article, then the answer is yes.
Yeah, well, that proves that Larry Klayman is either being a propagandist at this point or is grossly ill-informed regarding what the Founding Fathers were up to when they designed the Constitution. I think, frankly, you'll find the first 12 amendments were pretty much, yes, there are flaws in this thing and we're fixing it. And most of the stuff beyond that, except maybe the 13th and maybe the 15th, are tearing the country into pieces and attempting to reconstruct something brand new out of it. And I use that word reconstruct purposefully because, you know, of the Reconstruction era and the damage that was done to the United States Constitution during that period.
That's right. Well, you know, Chuck, when we teach our classes on the Institute on the Constitution, we point out to classes that there was a philosophical shift somewhere right around between the 12th, 13th Amendment and the rest of the amendments, where the previous amendments, the Bill of Rights and a couple that were added on afterwards in the 11th and 12th, all were geared toward and had a goal of limiting and controlling the power of the federal government. When Amendment 1 says Congress shall make no law, it's specifically pointed at a branch of the federal government. But from about 14 on, and specifically with those you mentioned, the 16th, the 17th Amendments, and following, the trend, the philosophy was to expand the federal government's reach, power, and control over the states by the expansion of the Bill of Rights to the states, from the federal government to the states, all the way up to taking away the state's ability to check the federal government by using populist procedures to elect United States senators so that the federal government could control that and not the states.
Right.
You know, and you look and you can go up through all the amendments, voting age, et cetera, whatever you want to look at. It was all done in a fashion that expanded the power, reach, control of the federal government, the central government, against the states. But prior to that, there was a balance that was struck. So basically what Larry Klayman's saying is, and I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but what I take from that is that it was okay up till the 27th Amendment for us to hand over more power to the federal government. But now we really want to get that power back. And the only way we can do it is to open it up in a federal convention and play around with the document some more.
To get some insight into Klayman's thinking on this, the next paragraph is very illustrative, and I will quote from it. But above and beyond amendments, a patchwork solution is no longer optimal. Meaning what? We can't no longer amend the Constitution to fix the problems?
That sounds to me like what he's saying.
That, exactly. The next line. The Constitution needs to be reanalyzed, pulled apart, and put back together, quote-unquote reconstituted, so to speak, to take into account the realities of the times we live in.
Oh, so
that should raise a red flag. In other words, the Constitution is no longer adequate for the time we live in. In other words, restriction of government power no longer works.
Yes, so that means that what he's really advocating for here, and he doesn't say this particularly, Chuck, but what he's really advocating for is a living document view. We need to change the document so that it can be flexible and it can work with the times, because you can only stretch the original document so far until it's obvious to everybody that you're basically being totally unconstitutional when you're passing laws and provisions like, oh, say, the NDAA or the Enemy Expatriation Act or others that we've talked about on this program. So we need to go back and retinker and change the Constitution around a little bit. Now, But, you know, if it's the times we live in, right now we have a president who says, I wish I didn't have to deal with Congress and I could just go directly and make laws. Does Larry want us to do that? Does he want that to be where we basically, let's say, oh, well, maybe we won't totally get rid of Article I Congress. We'll leave them there, but we just won't give them enough power that they can check the executive branch. Now, well, I would hope that that's not his position.
Barry, it's interesting you say that, because in the very next sentence, Larry Klayman destroys his own argument. He says, noble men are no longer in power and are not likely to be in the near or distant future. Okay. Now, listen to this. We need a newly crafted constitution that is just and not only promotes greater freedom, but also boxes in our corrupt leaders from pursuing their corrupt ways and provides redress and empowers we the people to hold them accountable. Well, you know, destroyed his own argument. There are not noble men in power and there aren't likely to be in the near or distant future. Who's going to rewrite this thing?
Those not so noble men, most likely. But even if they don't, and he's thinking it's all power to the people, if you remember, right now, supposedly under the current Constitution, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So if the people are inadequate because now they're voting in no longer noble men, what makes Larry Klayman think that that same group of people, this modern age that constitution no longer fits, is going to be able to make good decisions to, as he put it, and I'm glad you pointed that out, box in corrupt leaders from pursuing their corrupt ways. Chuck, there's no law that can be made to stop somebody from going after their goals and their passions, because people will do it regardless of whether there's a law or not. That's the reason why you have crime. When somebody wants to take something from someone else that doesn't belong to them, they either do it by deception or they do it by force. We write laws against it all the time, but Chuck, I don't know about you, but I'm still seeing it happen out there on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Yeah. Outlawing murder does not stop murder.
That's right. People still kill people, even though murder is outlawed.
It slows it down, definitely. The fact that it's against the law has kept a number of people, I'm sure, from actually pulling out a knife or a gun or a club or what, or poison or whatever.
Yes, but if those same people were writing, the laws, they would most certainly, as our Congress people do today, write in exceptions so that their actions are legitimate and valid, but everybody else's actions are suspect.
Well, Barry, here's what we're talking about here. Larry Klayman is going to attempt a top-down fix for a societal ill that is a bottom-up problem, and that is the fact that the American electorate is no longer a moral and noble people. We are not going to fix that by changing the Constitution of the United States of America. In fact, we're going to make things worse by doing this. Klayman should know that. But
Chuck, he engages in the fiction. And I'm looking at this article, too, and that in the next paragraph.
Yes, exactly.
This is how he structures it. He says that basically many conservatives are fearful that calling for and holding. I see he uses that term fearful. So he's already being pejorative against people who would say we need to be cautious.
And get out your baloney detector.
Baloney detector time, folks. Here it comes. Most conservatives are fearful that calling for and holding a second constitutional convention would open the door to liberals and the far left to pursue their agendas. But I say, what do we have to lose? We have no real Supreme Court that enforces our current constitution, much less believes in morals or ethics. And this current constitution is neither respected nor obeyed by most of our leaders in the executive and legislative branches of government. Chuck, I mean, you can tell us what the actual formal fallacies are in this, but I'm just going to get right down and say it. He's missing the forest for the tree.
Well, Barry, this is a simple one. It's a straw man. He's exaggerating the problem. And what he's doing is, it's also a red herring, because what he's saying is the problem is these guys over here. And what we're going to do, I love this, it's simply time to plug the loopholes with one coherent and forceful document, a holy grail, so to speak, to help restore and further our Judeo-Christian values and thus our posterity. Barry, that's what we have now.
I know.
What we are going to get is a secular mishmash and a positive law document that basically says rights come from government, not from God.
Okay, well, my question to Mr. Klayman is, And let's say that he's made an accurate statement here, and he maybe has, that our Supreme Court doesn't enforce the current Constitution, and the current document is not respected or obeyed by the executive and legislative branches, I'm sorry, he still hasn't made the case why creating a brand new document is going to change that parameter. Instead of changing the document, how about we change the makeup of the executive and the legislative branches and start, as if he believes that we the people have got all the power, start pushing and forcing those people, especially the executive and the U.S. Senate, to only appoint justices who are going to enforce the current Constitution and believe in morals and ethics. When you go to a Senate judiciary hearing when they're screening a nominee for the Supreme Court, they don't ask them so much about morals and ethics. They ask them, do you believe in the doctrine of stare decisis? Will you let all the previous decisions stand? Will you be in concert with the rest of the ones who have trashed the Constitution? See, now that's not a problem with the document. That's a problem with the people asking the question. That's
Bingo.
That's a problem with an electorate who has been, I guess, maybe with Mr. Clemens and others' help, persuaded, inveigled, chided, coerced, seduced into voting for candidates who don't stand for anything, just like we're seeing right now in this country leading up to the presidential election.
This document, Barry, actually only gets worse.
Yes, it does.
As we go along and he gives his top 10 reasons why a constitutional convention should be called for, he's actually calling for things, for instance, a quick and easy removal of presidents of the United States that would completely destabilize our form of government. And he cites the fact that impeachment is difficult and it has never actually been done successfully of a president. Yes, of a president. But it has been done successfully for instance, federal judges.
Yes.
And it has been done successfully for other office holders. And the fact is here, if you make it quick and easy to remove a president, you have essentially completely destabilized the executive branch of the government of the United States. Now, you and I have both decried the fact that the executive branch has too much power, but that's because the Congress refuses to rein them in by using the instrument they have in their hand, which is
the Constitution. Impeachment.
Yeah, and impeachment.
Impeachment, that's right. Which you find where? In the Constitution of the United States. But he says that's too slow, Chuck.
Well,
but then he gives his lasting solution to this. Perhaps we need a recall provision similar to what we see in California and other states with regard to governors. We know right now in Wisconsin, they're trying to do that with their sitting governor. And they're collecting signatures, but they're forcing. What you do is that creates constant turmoil. Constant exactly. upheaval, which means that anarchy is going to be the nature of the game. Now, you and I both know, Charles, that if you did this for the United States president, there would be petitions for recalls. I don't care who the president was. I don't care if the president would have happened to be Mahatma Gandhi. You would have a recall happening not more than about 30 days after a new president sworn into office. Because you're always going to have people who are going to say, my guy really should have won that. Let me take a look at 2000 with Bush Gore. You had a recall provision in place. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you would have had Al Gore at least for a little while until the other side got their signatures put together for a recall.
Exactly, Barry. That's why I say destabilization is the name of the game under Clemens' plan. What you're going to end up with is a banana republic that changes hands 133 times. In 20 years, you're going to find suddenly armed bands who are going to go around and demand that people, you know, stolen votes, violence, and that kind of thing, because things are so destabilized. This frankly goofy plan. What he's talking about is simply strange. And
doing a national
referendum recall petition. Okay, how are you going to set that up? X number of signatures of percentage of an electorate from each of the 50 states. X number of signatures to get it on the ballot over. I mean, this would be a nightmare scenario.
Well,
Barry.
You know what it leads to, Chuck? It leads to something that you and I have talked about on this program before, and that's the push, mainly by liberals, for what they call national popular votes. So the only way we could certify that a president should stay in office is if instead of the Electoral College and taking the numbers of the Electoral College and you have to create the majority of 270 plus, you basically, whoever wins the popular vote is the president. Now, of course, I'm sure that the claimant doesn't want this, but, you know, he's not the only one who's going to be in this potential new federal convention. I'm sure that some thoughtful and forethinking people would write in a little provision into that amendment that says, if the president was elected by a popular vote of over X percent, this provision would not apply to him.
Yeah.
And I guess the provision would be maybe 55%, maybe 54%, you know, maybe 50% plus two. Because it's all about the popular vote. You know, well, that's we can do away with all of these labyrinthian, mysterious provisions like the Electoral College or impeachment or other things like that. We can just say, hey, just like we get tired of a wife, we have no-fault divorce for president. I mean, honestly, Larry Klayman, you need to, I don't know what you've been drinking in the water where you are, but maybe you need to switch to a different type of water. But Chuck, well, Barry, it gets worse because his next provision's even worse than the first.
And I was going to say, Larry Klayman basically shows that he's got a handful of twos. What he thinks he's got is the slammer here with number two, but he's revealing his game. He wants an independent Justice Department, in effect a fourth branch of government not beholden to the president and the political and legal establishments. Klayman basically is tired of having to file suit to get things that he wants done, failing to realize that that's exactly why the system is set up the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, he goes through this big long thing about Valerie Plame and indictment of the former president of Israel and how that would never happen here. Well, I think it has happened here.
Does Richard Nixon's name ring any bells to people?
Yeah, exactly. And as I recall, he not only lost his job as president, but by action of his bar association, he lost his license to practice law.
Yeah, he lost not only the presidency, but his entire career. But the whole point is that I want to, instead of getting down into that minutiae, I want to go right back to the first sentence that he said. He wants to have a Justice Department that's a fourth branch of government.
Yes.
Okay, the reason why the Justice Department is under the executive branch of government right now is because that branch is responsible only for executing the laws. If we split the Justice Department out and give them a similar power to all three of the other branches, is he saying that the Justice Department then can come in and force the Supreme Court to give him the cases that he wants? Can the Justice Department turn around to the president and say, well, you can't do X, Y, and Z, but now that you're out from under us and you don't have to enforce the laws anymore, what's the president's role going to be? He'd probably become a super legislator.
It looks to me like what he would like to do is be the first attorney general under this independent agency, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it was my idea. I would like to hold this position.
Well, you know, and honestly, Charles, of all of the, you know, we've been doing this for a while now. We've been seeing these calls for federal constitutional conventions coming from various states. I mean, honestly, since the first convention, I mean, we've had these calls going for a while. Now, that doesn't mean that we should call one right now because, as opposed to a group like Friends of an Article 5 convention who are saying that every call that's been issued since 1789 still has validity. And so constitutes an ongoing call, and therefore we now have more than the Article 5 requirement of 34 states calling for a convention. But, I mean, this one's novel, and you're right. It must be just based on his own personal experience, because I have yet to see in any one of the calls from any state throughout history for splitting out and having a fourth branch of government called the Justice Branch.
And, in fact, this smacks... If you believe it or not, this smacks of what we talked about in the new state's constitution, that every branch of government, there are like six branches of government in that. And one of them, as I recall, is the justice. I could be wrong on that, but we talk about the book this comes from, the emerging constitution.
Right.
And which is a nightmarish document, by the way, of this constitution that allows us to be melded in with the rest of the world to form regional North American, South American unions, and then form that into a union with the rest of the world, who are also organized by their continental associations. This is part of a plan toward world government. Now, do I think Larry Klayman understands that? No, I don't think he gets it at all. I think he doesn't understand that he's already refuted his own argument, and that what he's proposing happen is a utopian view that will never take place, because he's not going to be in control of a constitutional convention. It will be the very people that he says are in office and are bad news right now
That's true. Now he keeps going, because some of the other ones that he mentions, at least the next three, are ones that I've heard or we've seen in various calls for a constitutional convention, balanced budget. But I laugh about this one, because even with this, he opens the door to invalidate something he said before in the article earlier, because he says, coupled with this, income tax levies need to be specifically outlawed.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't he say earlier that Those 27 amendments were added, were proved necessary to address serious structural flaws in the current Constitution.
That's
well, Chuck
right.
and I both know that that amendment is the 16th Amendment, which created the income tax, the federal yes. income tax that he basically says need to be specifically outlawed.
This is why, folks, you got to have your baloney detector on, and you got to think about what has been written in these articles, because these guys jump around and they play these games. It's sort of like three-card Monty. Which card is the queen? And you see the guy in the street corner, and he's got the cards bent in half, and he's flipping them around, and you're supposed to pick the queen. You bet and that you can beat the guy. And, of course, the guy cheats. Well, that's exactly what's going on. They're basically claiming as being a three-card Monty dealer here. And he's hoping that you bet everything in your wallet on the fact that you can pick the queen. You will not be able to pick the queen, and neither will Larry Klayman. And that's the bad part.
It is. It is. You know, he also talks about the fourth provision is this, since the current Constitution does not make specific reference to a right to life, this needs to be included in the new one. Well, it does make a specific reference, Chuck, because it's based upon the foundation of the Declaration of Independence, which says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, among those which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Well, I would point Mr. Klayman to the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no person can be deprived of their life or possessions without due process of law. So, yeah, the Fifth Amendment adds into this as well. So, yeah, it's in there.
Yeah, and I would say I think there's something in some of the language about treason trials. There can be no forfeiture, no corruption of blood, no certain kinds of forfeiture that point to a life issue. But the fact is, yes, the Constitution really does specifically guarantee the right to life. It's in the Fifth Amendment, and that's also, you're right, guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence, which is part of the organic law of the United States of America. Now,
yes.
The courts have stupidly held that that cannot be enforced. I laughed about that. I said, well, we've already enforced it. It was called the American Revolution. And it was fought. You guys may want to pay attention. It was taught between 1775 and 1783, and it was already enforced.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, very much so. Well, and then it keeps going on. It's like, well, no, we also have to have a right to privacy. Well, I'd go back to the Fifth Amendment again.
Bingo.
And the Fourth Amendment.
And the Fourth.
Yeah,
definitely.
The courts have been striking at the root of here lately.
Yes. So Mr. Klayman is, again, wrong. What he is pointing to, he continually points to the fact that we have these things he tacitly is saying these aren't in the Constitution, when in fact they are. He knows they are. This is him being disingenuous. What he's saying is the court refuses to enforce them, and therefore we need a new Constitution. Barry, I'm going to ask this question for about the umpteenth time.
Okay.
What makes him think these people are going to obey a new Constitution any better than they obey the old one?
Because that's his presupposition, Chuck. That's the whole point. I think he misunderstands the basic nature of man. He believes that people are basically good. They've just made bad decisions because the document isn't modernized enough to help them think through these decisions. And that, my friends, is a dangerous way to live your life.
That's right.
The basic nature of man, we know from Scripture, is that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? That the thoughts of man are evil continually. Without Christ, without that regeneration of the heart by God through the Holy Spirit and living a sanctified life, the basic nature of man is evil. It has been proven time and time and time again. We talk about the fact that you can't legislate morality. People say that. The point is, yes, you can. You always legislate somebody's morality. And the point is that where do they see the foundation of that morality coming from? Is it from the revealed absolute truth of God's word? Or is it from the shifting sand of humanism or non-biblical religions? And the point is, if you believe that man's basically good, you've missed the point. Because regardless of how good we think somebody is, each one of us, me included, have down inside us, because the flesh wars against the spirit daily, that tendency to, as Paul would say it, to be those killers of fathers and killers of mothers and fornicators and perverse and thieves. It's all there.
Yes.
It's all there because of the fall.
And what we have here is a failure to recognize the fact that man is intrinsically evil.
Yeah,
not
before people turn us off, we're not saying man's completely evil. But we're
right,
saying that man outside of God's changing of his heart because of the fall in the garden is evil. You can say, well, I know this person, they're a great guy, but they're not saved. Well, then, ladies and gentlemen, they may do some good things, but based upon whose standard? It's got to be based upon the standard of God and his righteousness for that, actually, because good and evil actually have real, solid, absolute definitions according to the author of those definitions, which is God, in his word, in his revealed word, which is infallible.
And you have actually pointed out another one of Clayman's problems. He doesn't believe in absolute definitions of some of these things. These things are allowed to float as far as he's concerned. And what he wants to do is he wants to carve in stone his own absolutes. He wants to make them up, quote unquote, holy grail. He wants to create this quote unquote holy grail. And what he's basically saying is the old one wasn't the holy grail. Well, it wasn't the holy grail. The only holy thing is the Bible, the only holy word of God. And it gives us the rules and the definitions of these things. And the fact is that the old Constitution was constructed on the basis of those rules and definitions, and the new one will not be.
No, absolutely not. I don't believe the delegates to a new constitutional convention are going to say, wait a minute, before we use this word, let's see what the Webster's 1828 dictionary has to say about it.
Well, absolutely. They're not going to. You're absolutely correct on that. Barry, this just goes honestly from bad to worse. Now, the next thing on the list, a lot of people have been clamoring for, but as you and I have noted in the past, what looks like a good idea on the front has turned out to be a disaster, for instance, in our own state.
Yes.
And that is term limits. In other words, there needs to be a specified term limit for president, a 1 6-year term, to lessening politicking to be elected to a second term. You know, the Confederates put this into their constitution, and I'm not speaking pejoratively about it. They gave the president a 1 6-year term, I think, on the same argument. The problem being that, especially with congressmen and senators, we've seen it in our own House of Representatives here. Term limits have been a disaster, and the only people that got empowered by term limits were the state party apparatuses.
Mm-hmm.
Because what would happen would be that you would get a good conservative elected, and the moderates and the liberals, for instance, in the Republican Party, would simply make sure that he got no committee assignments, he got no plum jobs, that had no traction with cabinet appointees and that kind of thing in the governor's cabinet if they were of the same party. And what would happen was the last part of his term would expire and he would be replaced. He would say, you know, maybe he wanted to run for another house, run for the Senate instead of the House of the Ohio House of Representatives. Oh, no, he couldn't get an endorsement. That guy's political career was over. What it did was essentially he couldn't run for office again, even though he might be popular in his district. The fact is that he got broomed out by the state party apparatus.
Right.
And that is what it has moved the Ohio Republican Party to the left, significantly to the left.
Yeah, that's true. Now, the other thing that I would point out to Mr. Clayman and to our listeners, if you think about this, if you gave the president, as he's promoting here, a single 6-year term, as he says, to lessen politicking to be elected to a second term, I just ask people to think back and look at the second terms of a number of our presidents and to find out that what you find in a second term, i.e. when they know that there's no politicking to be done to try to regain an office, they show their true colors. You see some of the most egregious, outrageous, unconstitutional policies being promoted from the executive branch when they know there's nothing left to lose. When they don't have to stand for election again, you get to see where they truly, truly live.
Think about this, Barry. When Barack Obama gets reelected, and
if he does,
I'm 85% or 90% sure he's going to.
Well, if things continue right now with this current crop of Republican candidates and the way the party and the media and even some of our good friends, Charles, continue to play the game the way that they've been handed the rules, it's probably going to turn out badly.
But what you're going to see, we've already seen that this president is openly fascist and moving rapidly to Marxism as he sees that he may just get reelected. In a second term, this guy is going to be completely unbridled. And the fact is, even if the Republicans take the House and the Senate, they're not going to do anything to rein him in. Boehner has already, the House Speaker of the House, Boehner, has already proven that he has neither a spine nor a stomach for confrontation with this president. And the fact is that the President of the United States is openly and willfully violating the Constitution of the United States of America virtually daily. And the House of Representatives, whose job it is to indict him on an impeachment hearing, refuses to do it. And if you'll recall, we were told, Barry, when Boehner was going to be the guy who was going to take over the House, and we were going to be really happy with the result. not really happy.
When we were told that, I sat there and thought, no, I know his history and his track record. I'm not going to be happy with that result. But you know what? No. That's where we are right now. But it's because so many people just want to say that, oh, well, we're going to look at it in light of the other guy. We're going to look at it in light of the other party and not look at it in light of, okay, has this guy been faithful to the Constitution that he swore to uphold and defend, or has he used it as his own personal playground to get what he wants?
Yeah.
Or ignored it per se.
So basically in the executive branch, the whole point is that second term goal actually tends to restrain presidents. It doesn't empower them. This 1 6-year term thing, you're very likely to get a guy that's okay. I'm here now. I got nowhere to go. Let's get it done.
Exactly.
And he could. And when I say get it done, it won't necessarily be a good thing.
If you look back, the second terms of George Bush, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, I mean, let's go all the way back, folks. You keep looking at second terms of as many presidents as you want to look at, and I don't think you could probably make a very good, strong case that any of them upheld policies and principles that they stated they were running on to get that second term.
I'm going to call you on one historical fact.
Go ahead. Call me up.
Okay. Bill Clinton got impeached in which one of his terms? The second one.
It was the second one. Yeah.
Now, what did that do to him? Was he empowered or restrained? That impeachment hearing, despite the fact that it failed, restrained him.
It restrained him, yes.
He did not do the damage he wanted to do because he didn't dare. He'd been impeached once, and you had guys like Arlen Specter playing Scottish law in the Senate, who basically refused to look at any of the evidence. Everybody saying, well, this is the mantra being this is about sex, when in fact what it was about was perjury. And a president really doesn't have the right to perjure himself in any setting. There is no inherent right of the presidency to allow the president to perjure himself. But the fact is, he was restrained by his impeachment. And as you recall, Bush, they talked about impeaching Bush, and it turned out to be just a joke effort. But yes, these presidents, well, look at Roosevelt with four terms. The guy was a virtual dictator at the end.
Absolutely.
And he had the war. And what restrained him was the fact that there were a couple times in 1940 and 1944 that looked like he would lose. And that actually restrained him as well. So that is a perfect illustration of exactly what we're saying. He had to restrain himself. And of course, he died 20 or 45 days into his term.
Yes.
Into his last term. And of course, Truman came in and he was restrained because he wanted his own term, to be elected to his own term. So he was restrained. We have to keep in mind that these guys are restrained by the idea of having to face the electorate in 4 years.
Exactly. Exactly. So Clayman's idea of term limits is only going to make the thing that he is complaining about now, which is the fact that there are no noble men who are upholding or obeying and recognizing the Constitution and being corrupt and pursuing corrupt ways, that's just going to strengthen it. Honestly, I'm not sure why he didn't stop and think through this a little bit more carefully, but as we keep going here, we're going to see that he's really not even thinking from a position that he's saying that he'd like for them to be at. Because he talks about, now a couple of the other ones, American citizens having standing. Well, that means that you don't have to be an aggrieved party to bring a lawsuit. Well, Larry Clayman's an attorney. I can see where that would help generate his business. If anybody and everybody can sue over anything, regardless of whether or not they actually have an grievance, because right now you have to have a current case or controversy before the court. In other words, you have to be an injured party.
Well, what that does
now,
is
anybody under his new constitution, anybody can sue anybody for anything at any time. Well, that's a boon for trial attorneys.
Well, not only that, Barry, it makes everything a constitutional question.
It makes everything.
In fact, everything isn't a constitutional question.
But then think about this, too, Chuck. for those folks who would be out there who listen to Larry Klayman, who we would consider conservative, more or less, folks, what's that going to do to your right to life positions? What's that going to do to the defense of traditional marriage? What's that going to do to any issue? Prayer in schools, if you like that, which I think is kind of an oxymoron because schools shouldn't exist in the first place, to be able to have Bible studies in your neighborhood. Anybody under Klayman can sue you, and they don't even have to show that they're harmed by the action or by the law the way it's passed. And the courts would be open 24/7, Chuck. It would be like, you know, it would be like the 7-Eleven of jurisprudence.
And that brings up a point that I want. Larry Klayman has a point on one thing in the sixth proposal, and that is term limits.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I've said for quite some time, that there should be term limits for federal judges. This thing about serving in times of good behavior has simply not worked. Because there is no fear. I realize that I'm kind of stepping into his argument, but the fact is the Congress won't impeach them. But the fact is, if you gave a decently long term to a judge, like 7 years,
mm-hmm.
for instance, let's take the Supreme Court, 7 years, and you staggered the terms so that every president would get to a point, it probably, you know, if they even a one-termer would get to a point. At that point, one or two judges, you know, I worked out the math once. I don't remember what it was.
Sure.
But the fact is, because somebody like Sotomayor or Ruth Bader Ginsburg or any number of these who have just come out with egregious opinions simply wouldn't last past a 1 7-year term. You'd have to deal with them for 7 years and then they'd be gone and you could replace them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. Now, but let me qualify it on something here. We could have the situation like you had, and I believe it was in Florida, where you had a judge who basically high crimes and misdemeanors were his stock and trade. He was removed from the bench, and he now serves in Congress. It's the Representative Alcee Hastings.
And I hate to tell you, that's my mother's representative.
So basically, I don't know if those term limits for judges are going to be very good or not, because they could be the same people who then turn around and fill the legislative branch and say, well, no, we can't ever, you know, prosecute or impeach a judge.
Hastings is an interesting case because the government had him dead to rights. He was corrupt as anything, and he went and played race card.
Yes, he did.
In his district, and those horrible racists railroaded me out of office. I think William Jefferson tried that in Louisiana. It didn't work. You know, the guy with the freezer full of money and
the cold cash case. Yes.
Yeah. Cold cash case. Then he made the National Guard help him move it out of his freezer.
Exactly.
When they evacuated him.
Well, here we go. So, okay, I'll give you that one. I think we need to think through that provision just a little bit more carefully.
And Barry, that's the bottom line. We need to think these things through and talk about them. And if we come to a decision that maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea, now let's do a constitutional amendment. And we'll see what everybody else thinks about it. Under Klayman's provision, this is something that requires time to ponder carefully, not something that you just do at the snap of a finger and appoint a bunch of guys who are not going to be noble and good men.
And if people think that if we call a federal constitutional convention, that it's going to be one that gets impaneled and like some blue ribbon commissions works for years, spends a lot of taxpayer dollars, and then finally comes up with a proposal that looks nothing like what they were charged to do. You know, what's going to end up happening is Congress gets, under Article 5, Congress gets to set all the provisions. The states don't have a call in it. The Congress could say, you're only going to meet for 30 days and you gotta have a new document within 30 days. I'm not sure that that's enough time to really, you know, even with Klayman's list, but looking at all of the various entities out there who've been asking for various things, I think what you're going to end up with is a mishmash that's going to do so much damage to this land that we love and care about that it could be irreparable.
Well, think about this, Barry. This is exactly the kind of polyglot patchwork that Klayman is claiming he's trying to fight. He's going to get with this model he's proposing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, he goes on, Chuck. I don't want to belabor that point too long on my end. But he goes on and says that, you know, his Eighth Amendment mandates English as the official language. Okay. Do we really have to put that in a constitution? I mean, it makes no sense. And what happens if you have states out there who, as we are seeing, many of them are going to, you know, because of their mix, whether it's by illegal immigration or not, but because of their mix of citizenry, they are doing bilingual type things.
Okay. Do you know there's one state in the union that has a bilingual constitution?
No, I did not. I was not aware of that.
Do you know who it is? Okay, since you don't know, you didn't know that.
I'm going to guess either Oklahoma or New Mexico.
New Mexico has a constitution written both English and Spanish. Now, Puerto Rico, if they decide to come into the union, will probably have a primarily Spanish constitution. Do we want to exclude them as a possible state because they are a majority Spanish-speaking population? Now, most people in Puerto Rico also speak a smattering, at least, of English.
Sure.
But do we want to exclude them because their primary language is Spanish? I'm not so sure. If Puerto Rico wants to voluntarily come into the union and understand that most of us speak English, and Americans are kind of dumb about second languages, we're really not very smart about it.
Well, and it's kind of funny because, and please forgive me if this offends anybody, but the arrogance of the American not to try to learn other languages is not being repeated in other countries around the globe where
That's
multilingualism
right.
is expected.
English is spoken almost universally in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
They at least learn a smattering of English.
Along with their native Russian or their native Serbian Croatian dialects, their native...
Yep.
Swedish or Spanish or French or it just goes on and on and on. So, but
there are countries in Europe where four languages are spoken.
Switzerland being one of them.
German, French, Italian, basically is a patois.
Right.
English
and English. Yes. But you know, and before our listeners get all upset at us. We're not saying that that means that all road signs and driver's licenses and everything else have to be done in multiple. You know, you have to have a road sign that has English and Spanish and Japanese and French and Arabic and everything else for every road sign. That's not necessarily what we're getting at here. But what we're getting at here is once you ensconce something into your constitution like that, what happens if later on, and I'm going to use Clayman's argument for why he wants to do this in the first place, that the times change, and the people of America decide that they want to start being more neighborly to French Canadian Quebecers, and so we all decide that we want to start speaking French in this country.
Well, here's the way I see it. This is not a federal issue. This is a state sovereignty.
It's a state issue. That's right.
If Puerto Rico wants to enter the union and have road signs in Spanish, then okay. If I want to visit Puerto Rico, I'd better learn how to read stop signs and yield signs and those kinds of things in Spanish, because that is their prerogative. Same thing in New Mexico. That should be up to the states, not the federal government mandating that English will be spoken here, period. We bury our entire history. We've had enclaves where people spoke their native languages.
Yes.
The fact is that New York City is a patchwork of little places where Italian was spoken, where Polish was spoken, where Yiddish was spoken, where Chinese was spoken, where Japanese was spoken. All these places, first generation people came, they didn't speak English. Their kids ended up speaking English and their grandchildren. But the fact is, very often, the children and grandchildren also held on to the Italian language.
Well, you know what? You're saying New York City, let's bring it a little closer to home. How about Cleveland?
Exactly.
Where Polish could be a second official language of Cleveland.
Exactly.
Or Cincinnati, which has a German heritage.
Yes. And for years, in fact, German was a strong second to English.
Yeah, exactly. So again, this is a more local issue that Clayman's trying to raise to the level of a constitutional necessity, only because he understands that it hits a populist and popular note with the people today because of the issue of illegal immigration.
Bingo. It's populism. And with the usual problems of populism, it is a spur-of-the-moment thing rather than a well-thought-out position.
Well, that's what every one of these is, including the ninth, which is one of my personal favorites here, not because I agree with him, but because it's really exposing his thinking. He wants to clarify that capital punishment is cruel and unusual punishment. Okay, well, you know what? It may be, but the punishment's supposed to fit the crime, is my understanding, Charles. And so if someone brutally murders someone, then possibly them losing their life wouldn't be necessarily cruel or unusual. And he says, given the flaws in our justice system, and I do agree with him there, our justice system is very flawed, mainly because it's not based upon the justice of absolute truth of God's word. It's based upon tweakings and reworkings from humanists who believe that man's basically good. So if somebody murders somebody or goes on a killing spree or a raping spree or whatever, we just need to just rehabilitate the person and get them back out into the society. And it's like, well, that's not necessarily true.
Do you remember where Clayman started out? We want to write our Judeo-Christian values
exactly.
in stone.
Exactly. Thank you. That's exactly what we are doing.
And here we are taking the stone that is already written out that says there is a death penalty and it comes from God and it has to be adjudicated very carefully and under very specific circumstances.
That's right.
And saying, no, we're going to do that. And you take a hammer and chisel that right back out of the stone.
Well, and the point is, he says that basically it must be eliminated, and in any event, does not square with a pro-life constitution.
Sorry.
Which I'm sorry, it's like, okay, now he's changing his standard, Chuck. Instead of going back to that Judeo-Christian base, which is based in the Bible, now he's saying, well, it doesn't square with our new view of this document.
And in fact, that standard of justice is based on the idea that the civil magistrate holds the sword. And what Clayman is trying to do here is equivocate someone adjudicated guilty of the crime of murder with the unborn who has obviously committed no crime.
Right. And then he ends that paragraph by saying life imprisonment is far more punitive if actually enforced. Now, wait a minute. Punitive on whom?
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
It's the taxpayers who pay to house somebody who, by adjudication, has committed heinous and brutal crimes, any one of which would be legitimate for him to lose his life over. They're not crimes of property where remuneration and restitution might be the biblical standard. These are crimes of violating the thou shalt not kill provisions of our base document, which is God's word. So life imprisonment is really far more punitive on the families of the victims, upon the citizens and taxpayers of the communities which have to pay for the housing and medical care and food and education and everything of those prisoners. And it's far more punitive upon many of the other prisoners who might be around that person. Because, you know, Chuck, as I'm dealing and working in some prison environments now with some of the things
right.
that I'm doing, it's not outrageous to have someone who was in that prison for a property crime to end up being carried out on a stretcher dead because a murderer decided he got mad at him and took his life.
That's right. People are murdered all the time. Sharpened toothbrushes and
you name it. It goes on and on.
You make somebody mad because you won't acquiesce to some horrible act they want you to perform, you know, some gang that exists in prison that the prison authorities do nothing to stop. Suddenly a guy who goes in for some minor league offense because some hanging judge somewhere decides that he needs to go to the big house to teach him a lesson. It's really, this argument is completely lame when you look at it in the big picture versus this small picture, this emotional appeal. And this is an emotional appeal. This is an appeal to, I'm trying to think what kind of an appeal. This is really a populist appeal.
It's a populist appeal, yes. It's also an appeal to fear, too.
It's an appeal to fear in some ways, but the idea that people who are adjudicated guilty of murder should basically be allowed to sit around because it's more punitive for them. Well, the whole idea of punishment, Barry, is correction.
Yes.
These people the whole point behind God's decree of the death penalty is that, okay, they're now beyond correction.
Well, you know, and think about this too, Chuck. If you take Clayman's structure here, that we need to take somebody and put them in prison for life because we want to be punitive, which means we're exacting revenge. Because that's
right.
what punitive is. It's exacting
exactly.
revenge. I challenge Larry Clayman. Wouldn't that be far more cruel and unusual a punishment than taking the killer's life and exacting justice instead of revenge?
Yes, exactly. Now, I frankly find the 10th proposal chilling. And the reason I do is because I know, I'm not an expert, but I know some of the history of the French Revolution. And this is an attempt at, quote unquote, forming citizens committees.
Yes, it is.
Or vigilance committees, if you will, who are going to go around indicting anybody who they don't like. And we've already seen this. Do you remember on some people who called themselves conservatives who were running around doing these silly indictments from, quote unquote, what were they called? Ecclesiastical courts. One, But it was, there were common law courts.
Oh, there's that too, yes.
These common law courts, I didn't mean ecclesiastical courts. That's basically showmanship, those ecclesiastical courts. But the common law courts, those guys were serious. They were talking about handing out subpoenas and at some point arresting people and that kind of thing to make them show up at these common law courts.
Well, and it went, it went so far as to have some of those folks filing, I don't want to say a writ, but filing liens against the property of, mainly it was judges, in amounts of $10 million in gold bullion. You know, that was the kind of thing. And they would go down to the courthouses and they would get these time stamped and filed before the clerks understood what it was that they were filing. And so you had a sitting judge who would go to maybe get a car loan or something. Oh, I'm sorry, you've got a lien against you. We can't give you any credit. What do you mean a lien? It says here that you owe $10 million in gold bullion to this common law court.
Yeah, and this is exactly what we've got here. This is vigilante justice.
And Chuck, what this does is this sets our current system on its ear.
Exactly.
Think carefully through this. We do have citizen grand juries. We have a grand jury system. It's there for determining whether or not someone charged with a crime should actually stand trial for the crime. That's as far as a grand jury goes. And yes, it's made up of citizens. It's made up of citizens of the United States who sit on the grand juries. But the point is, that jury does not try that potential criminal. But even in a jury trial, that jury isn't the one that's doing the trying of the case. That's the prosecutor. They're adjudicating whether the law and the facts of the case deserve the penalty that's being asked.
Exactly. And what we could see in this case is some of these runaway groups who all you need really is to get yourself in and get yourself, you and a couple of your buddies, on one of these quote-unquote citizens grand juries, and you can wreak havoc. This is, once again, Klayman is basically saying that, you know, we live in this destabilized period. This would completely destabilize the judicial system.
Well, and he goes even farther here, and, you know, maybe it's just hyperbole because of his writing style, but he says that basically these citizen grand juries would be there to indict and try government officials and other, that means everybody else, who violate our laws and ethics. Whose ethics?
Yeah,
who determines that? I honestly don't want to be, you know, because I work in the pro-life arena, I don't want to be dragged in front of a citizen grand jury who could take away my freedom or possibly my life. Oh, I forgot. We get away with capital punishment in his fantasy world. So throw me in prison for life, a citizen grand jury made up of the heads of NARAL, Planned Parenthood, and a lot of the gay rights groups.
And that was exactly my point. This could be Madame Defarge sitting in on the grand jury knitting while you're basically carted off to be stuck in the basement of some prison someplace. Having been an admirer from time to time of Klayman in the past, I'm beginning to wonder if he's had a stroke or something or some kind of a breakdown, because this does not look like some of the things he's done in the past. Unfortunately, we're running really short on time. I think we're going to have to wrap it up here.
Okay. I understand that, but I guess what we're going to leave it at is, according to Larry Klayman, we're fear-mongers because we're conservatives who are, quote-unquote, fearful. We're not fearful of a constitutional convention. We are weighing the facts of history. We are weighing the proposals that are in front of us and looking at how they might work out. We're weighing whether or not his base thesis, which is we've moved beyond the restrictions of the Constitution that's kept us as a free country for over 228 years. We've moved beyond that, and so we need something new and different. New does not equate to better, ladies and gentlemen. The Bible is very clear about do not remove those ancient boundaries which your forefathers have set. We believe our forefathers, politically, the founding fathers, set a pretty solid landmark here with the Constitution of the United States. It has flaws. We're not saying it's a divinely inspired document by any stretch of the imagination, but that's what the amendment process has been for. Now, if the people, if you remember that the Constitution was made for a moral and religious people and it is wholly inadequate to the governance of any other, perhaps what Klayman is inadvertently admitting is that we've lost a moral and religious foundation as a people. Now, that will not be fixed by a new constitutional document. It will only be fixed by going back to the infallible, absolute truth revealed in God's Word. That's the only hope for our country, ladies and gentlemen. It's not in changing the documents. It's not even in changing the hands on the tiller by voting in or voting out candidate A versus candidate B. It's by changing the hearts of the people to turn back to God, to turn back to true justice, and to turn back to a structure that ensures that we have those inalienable rights of life, of liberty, and of the pursuit of happiness.
And with that, we are out of time. We want to hear from you, so join us at www.principledpolicy.com and join us again for another Principles and Policies at 5:30 during the week and noon on Saturdays.